Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nolan. I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, we take on a very important topic, a serious topic, that generally has been given either little or no attention in the mainstream media, or frequently, when it is discussed, it is discussed in such a way that does not lay out the full context of its significance. Today, we are addressing hydrofracking, what the actual science, independent science, tells us, what the government and gas industry is doing, and most importantly, what are the health consequences and environmental impact upon all of us. Our panel consists of three individuals. First off will be Professor Anthony Ingrafia. He is the Dwight C. Baum Professor of Engineering at Cornell University, where he has taught structural and fractural mechanics for almost 35 years. Among his specialties is computer simulation and physical testing of complex fracturing processes, which has resulted in over 250 research papers. At Cornell, he spearheads the fracking research. He has been a principal investigator in over $35 million in research and development projects for the National Science Foundation, NASA, U.S. Army Engineering Waterways Experimental Station, U.S. Department of Transportation, the Gas Research Institute, among others. He has received awards from the International Association of Computer Methods and Advances in Geomechanics and has twice won the National Research Council Award and also for his research in rock mechanics. Professor Ingrafia is also the president of Physicians, Scientists, and Engineers for Healthy Energy, and he is among 82 prominent scientists being considered for the membership on the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Science Advisory Board on hydrofracking. His website is psehealthyenergy.org. He will be joined by Jennifer Kreil. Jennifer is an activist for environmental advocacy for over 30 years, and is the new executive director for Earthworks, a 30-year-old national organization dedicated to protecting the environment from the blows of mineral oil and natural gas extraction and development and their impact on social issues and human rights. Earlier, she was the program director for the Rainforest Action Network and a program director for its campaigns to protect old growth forests from the oil and energy industries. She has had a career that includes stints with Greenpeace, Earth Island Institute, and Sea Turtle Restoration Project. She serves on the advisory committee of the Business Ethics Network. Her website is earthworksaction.org. And our final panelist today will be Dominic Frangillo. At 22 years of age, Dominic is the youngest person to serve on the town council of Caroline, New York. He is now in his second term. He has worked locally and globally on environmental issues, including being a U.S. youth delegate to the United Nations climate negotiations in Durban in 2011, Cancun 2010, Copenhagen 2009, and Bali 2007. In Copenhagen, he delivered a statement calling on President Obama and Congress to renew America's leadership in clean energy. Dominic was a regional coordinator for PowerShift, the nation's largest national summits on youth clean energy action, and was elected by Governor Patterson's office to help develop New York State's far-reaching 2050 climate action plan. He currently works as community energy educator and advisor to the Tompkins Energy Conservation Corps with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Tompkins County. His website is Dominic, and I'll spell his last name. Frangillo is Frangillo.com. Those are our panelists. Now, at first, I'd like to welcome all of you to our program, and now my concerns. If you have not heard the program in the past, we're also video streaming. We're heard in over 140 countries, and we take this very seriously because it is my belief, I know it is many of your beliefs, that you're not going to hear the word natural gas or hydrofracking talked about unless it's in some positive light by the mainstream media. But it's not just the mainstream media. The reason for this particular program today is because just a week ago I was listening to Democracy Now!, and on many issues I certainly am in alignment and respect the integrity by which they approach their topics. But there are issues that I would share a difference of opinion. When the guest on the program, who had been a major climate, global warming and climate change denialist, had shifted over and wrote a book and was there to promote the book, the person made three statements that I could readily see a major debate ensuing around. That the future was for those who would embrace natural energy in the form of gas and gas hydrofracking. In the topic of China, and China has more coal burning electrical plants than any place in the world and is adding them at a very alarming rate, the solution there was to shift over to gas. That it would have been foolish to consider solar, wind, geothermal, energy wave, or any other form of natural, non-toxic, and non-polluting sources of energy because they were 30 years out. And by that time, the environment would have tipped. But we could make a big difference today if we put the one really clean energy, meaning it's about 30% less polluting than, let's say, coal or oil, and that is natural gas. There was no challenge to that. I'd hoped there would be, but there was none. And you can hear that going to her website and downloading it. But then when she mentioned the Koch brothers, he mentioned that the Koch Foundation and the Koch brothers were not a controversial issue and did not deserve to be denigrated. And that was the end of it. Well, for me, that was the beginning. I've written extensively on the subject of gas hydrofracking. We've protested in front of the governor's office in the largest anti-fracking demonstration in front of the governor's office in New York, where we combined anti-nuclear, closing down nuclear power in New York at Indian Point, and anti-fracking and anti-genetic engineering. We've combined the consumer efforts on all three issues. I believe that it's more important that we join together on important issues one at a time and take on all the issues in time so we have unity. That is why this program is important. Let us begin our discussion. First, welcome to our program, Professor.
Good to be here with you, Gary. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Let's begin with your own Cornell study published in the peer-reviewed journal Climate Change Letters that discovered that compared to coal, shale gas greenhouse footprint is at least 20% greater and even perhaps twice as great over a 20-year period. Now, what are the primary observations for this conclusion, and also briefly share with our listeners why methane gas contributes more to global warming than CO2 emissions, and also please address the confusion people might have in the fact that natural gas is cleaner when burned compared to coal, but that the greenhouse methane released is from extracting the gas from the shale beds, because that's where they win some of the arguments with those who are not fully informed. The forum is yours.
Thank you for the opportunity. Our paper, published a little over a year ago, was the very first peer-reviewed paper to address this simple question. Is methane, natural gas, a cleaner fossil fuel than its cousins, coal or petroleum? That's a science question to be asked and answered using the best available science. Ours was the first paper in the peer-reviewed literature to try to address that question. We did our research and concluded that although upon burning natural gas, the amount of carbon dioxide that's emitted per unit of energy is much less than that emitted by burning coal or petroleum, that's not the whole story. The key question behind all three of the issues you just raised is what is the life cycle implication of the production, storage, cleaning, transportation, and burning of methane on climate change. And that raises the question of not just the carbon dioxide that's emitted when it's burned, but the emission of methane itself. So during the process of drilling a well, fracking a well, flow back from fracking, dehydrating the gas, cleaning the gas, storing the gas, compressing the gas, and transporting the gas through pipelines to its end use, there are leaks. There are leaks of methane. Some of those leaks are accidental. Some of those leaks are not accidental. They're purposeful. And when methane is leaked into the atmosphere, it becomes a greenhouse gas, just like carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. But most importantly, greenhouse gases like methane are much more potent in their climate warming effects than carbon dioxide. One of the misconstruings of our is to what extent methane is more potent than carbon dioxide. The answer to that question depends upon what time frame you're willing to look over. And the industry wants us to either ignore methane emissions, saying that they're inconsequential, or at best, they're saying, well, let's look at them over a 100-year timeline. But as recent science has shown, we don't have 100 years to wait to do something about climate change. We have less than a generation, less than a human generation. We have perhaps 20 to 30 years to do something very substantial. In that 20-year time period, methane is over 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide in its warming potential. Let me put those two facts together. Those are scientific facts. Methane is over 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide for global warming, and methane leaks. If only a very small percentage of it leaks, a small percentage of the lifetime production of a well, you multiply that small leak by a big number. The number in this case is over 100. And suddenly that small leak more than doubles the greenhouse gas effect, the warming effect of methane over its carbon dioxide effect, therefore making methane much more potent as a greenhouse gas over its life cycle than coal or petroleum. I hope I answered all three of your questions in that long answer.
You did, and there is no long answer. There's only the correct answer on this program, so I appreciate that. Let's do a follow-up question. If it is the case that hydrofracking is a highly polluting industry, then what does that say about the gas industry that natural gas is a renewable alternative to other fossil fuels based upon energy sources? That's their second message to us.
Well, first of all, it's not renewable. Once you burn it, it's gone. Mother Nature is still in the process of producing natural gas, but on a time frame that's irrelevant to humans. It's taken over 300 million years for the natural gas supply in shales, or in shales right now, to become available. And if we keep burning it, the industry is moving towards, will exhaust the entire supply of shale gas available in the United States in somewhere between 10 and 20 years. So it's not renewable. It's hard to an aid to reduce climate change. That's a laughable statement. First of all, it's a fossil fuel. Show me a fossil fuel that helps climate change. The argument that the industry tries to make is that, well, since it's better than coal or petroleum, we're going to die a longer death, or we'll walk a longer plank. I don't buy that. That's just nonsense.
I appreciate that follow-up. I may be wrong on this, and I don't have a problem you correcting me, but at one time, weren't you also a major figure in consulting for gas drilling corporations? And if that is the case, if I'm correct at all on that, what was your primary realization that made you shift your views about the benefits of natural gas?
Well, I'm not sure I was ever major. That would be other, for others to judge. I certainly did work as a researcher for and a consultant to the oil and gas industry for about 20 years. As you noted in the introduction, my basic training is in rock mechanics and specifically in well drilling, hydraulic fracturing, and all other aspects of breaking rock. So during that 20 years, I became very much familiar with the culture of the oil and gas industry, became very respectful of the brilliance of the scientists and engineers that are hired by the very best corporations, the best and brightest students that we produce in our industry, in our universities, and go to work for an industry that's trying to do something that's very complex, grabbing energy from underground. So yes, I did work for a long time as a researcher at Cornell and as a direct cook consultant for a number of the key companies. But about 4 or 5 years ago, I began to realize that what was being promoted now was what I call an extreme form of energy production. And that is what we've now termed fracking, which is a very short word that has a very long meaning. When I use the word fracking, and I presume your listeners now understand it to the same degree, by fracking we mean high volume, high pressure production of gas from shale formations using long lateral drilling, multi-stage fracking, concomitant well pads with many wells per pad. It takes a long time to say that, and so the mainstream media just wants to use the simple handle of fracking. But when we put all that together, the fact that we're going from tens of thousands of gallons of fracking fluid to millions of gallons, from one well on a pad to 10, 20 wells on a pad, from one pad every 10 square miles to one pad every square mile, from a few thousand wells in a state to a few hundred thousand wells in a state, suddenly that's an extreme form of energy production. It's an abomination. It's taking things to a scale, a temporal scale and a spatial scale that, in my opinion, my humble opinion as a scientist and engineer, is ludicrous. It's just a misuse of the technology that many of us worked on for many years.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Public perception over natural gas is increasingly opposed to it, particularly in those communities where fracking has taken place for a length of time and the dangerous adverse effects are now fully visible. But if you've ever been to any of the community meetings, especially in depressed areas in Pennsylvania, on the western border with New York State in Tioga County, very depressed there economically. So when people come in with a beautiful slideshow, a nice presentation, and they tell you that this is all natural, it's going to give them some royalties, it won't really adversely affect their property, it's certainly not going to hurt their water and air, and people suddenly think, well, okay, we're having a rough time, let's take advantage of this. Well, and then they see the truth of it. And simultaneously, the gas industry has embarked on a very aggressive campaign, in my opinion, full of myths and lies, to convince Americans about natural gas safety and benefits. I'm sure you've seen the ones on television. Make it look very compatible with most people's comfort zone. Well, before the problem, I looked at the Marcellus Drilling News website. And these people are rapid in their attacks on fracking opponents. You say anything about fracking, they're all over you. They would have us believe that fracking fluid is safe as a breakfast drink. So I'd like to review some of these myths and ask you to debunk them. I'm only going to give you two or three, and then you can take it from there. One of the biggest myths is that the migration of the fracking fluids that they put into the ground and well leakage that distributes numerous toxic chemicals in the ground and find their way into the water resources, the industry tells us this is very rare and easily corrected. What is the truth on this, and why is the fluid migration, in fact, very common?
Fluid migration is very common because any time one drills a well, an oil well or a gas well, through thousands of feet of rock into an oil or gas-bearing formation, you're punching a hole in a natural seal. Nature, over hundreds of millions of years, has sealed that hydrocarbon safely outside the human experience. But every time one drills a well, as I said, you punch a hole in it. And as everybody knows, from common everyday experience around their house and garage. When you punch a hole in something and you don't want it to leak, you need a gasket. You need a seal so that what you want is only coming up, in this case, what the industry calls the production casing, the innermost steel pipe through which the oil or gas is supposed to come to the surface, and it's only supposed to come into that pipe. But around that pipe, you have to have a seal. Otherwise, fluids and gases can migrate outside that steel pipe and find their way either into an underground source of drinking water or to the surface, both of which have obvious detrimental environmental and health effects. Making a seal is extremely difficult. The industry has been working on techniques, technologies, and materials for sealing gas and oil wells for nearly 100 years. It can never be done. They're doing about as best they can now because obviously they've been doing it for a century and over a million wells. What they have found, they do statistical analysis and go out and measure those wells that have failed, is that on average, one of every 20 wells that is drilled, a gas well, an oil well, begins to leak immediately. That is, the seal is imperfect immediately. Common experience is anytime someone builds something, they're working in the workshop or the competent engineer is working on some very complex NASA space mission, is as things grow old, they the industry also knows that as wells age, the rate at which the seal fails increases with time. In industry data, which is published, industry writers in industry journals, available for any legislator or regulator or common citizen to get, shows that over time, something like half of all the oil and gas wells that have been drilled will leak or are leaking. And as I said, roughly one of every 20, about 5%, leak immediately. It's just very difficult to put that seal in initially and to have that seal last. Even after a gas or oil well becomes non-productive and is dependent, and it's plugged, hopefully, the production casing. But if something is leaking around that casing because the, quote, gasket, then plugging does nothing to ameliorate the problem of a leaking well. So every new well that we drill, we're leaving for our children and our grandchildren, a long-term problem and a long-term environmental problem.
Okay, now another myth is that fossil waterbed aquifers, which are where a lot of people have no knowledge of what a fossil waterbed aquifer is, and contrary to replenishable aquifers, are extremely deep in the earth. And we are led to believe that because of their depth, fracking fluids pose no threat to the water resource therein. And just as an aside, I'm writing an article on the largest aquifer in the United States, one that goes around 16 states, 178,000 square miles. And the amount of water being taken out currently is 500% greater than the amount of rain that is replenishing it. These are prehistoric. When they're dry forever, and it would take 6,000 years of adequate rain to fill them up to a level where they could be used again. So that's not going to happen. And yet, now the president, President Obama, has agreed to aggressively pursue allowing a tar sands company to bring pipeline that would go right through there, jeopardizing that. And people don't understand that if you get gas, oil, or any toxic chemical into one of these prehistoric aquifers, especially one that's this large, that supplies the entire Midwest of the United States, Kansas, Indiana, all those places with water for people to drink, tens of millions of people drink the water using on farming and industry for municipalities, you're going to end up creating a crisis that we are not prepared to deal with. But their idea is, well, A, it's never going to happen. We're not going to pollute any aquifer, deep or otherwise. We certainly wouldn't pollute one that, one that, Okanagan, one of the largest in the United States, in fact, one of the largest in the world. And I'm saying, how can you give us that guarantee? So could you please take us through this very important myth, the potential or actual pollution of our water supplies, and what it would mean if the chemicals from gas hydrofracking got into these, and what that would do to the drinkability or usability of that water?
Gary, you're right on the very edge of my technical expertise. I'm certainly not a hydrogeologist. That particular aspect of deep, large aquifer contamination is something I have not looked at. But I will say this, which is in my area of expertise. When one performs shale gas development over a large region, statewide, and one claims that one's going to put hundreds of thousands of shale gas wells in that region, and in every one of those wells, you're injecting, say, 5 to 10 million gallons of frac fluid, then you claim that only about 10% of it ever comes back to the surface, and you claim that the rest of it is safely ensconced down below somewhere, and it's never going to do any harm. It's a ludicrous statement from a scientific view, because you don't know. You can't know what is there over a large region. You can't know what large volumes of frac fluid are going to do over human time. One can never know exactly what's down there electrically. One can never know exactly what's down there chemically. And the larger the region and the more volume of fluid you pump into that region, the higher the probability that something untoward will happen. That's basic common engineering sense. You're playing with statistics, playing with the tail end of distribution curves, where we have little knowledge, high risk of high consequence. So extrapolating that to the particular case of the pipeline that's be transporting tar sand product across the upper Midwest through the heartland, the breadbasket of our country, I don't know how to do that.
Okay, fair enough.
Somebody should be doing it, and I hope somebody is doing it. That's a quantitative risk analysis problem of a scale, of a national scale, that demands the best and the brightest.
All right. Then one other area that will back into what you recently said about the clusters of these gas hydrofracking wells. One growing practice in gas drilling is large land expanses of clustered wellheads, and these are posing, my belief, some environmental threats. However, the gas industry tells us that cluster drilling reduces surface impact. So would you give us your perspective on what is cluster drilling and what is surface impact, and why could this pose an even higher risk?
Sure. This is one of my favorite. So I'll address both parts of your question. I'll do the second part first. What is cluster drilling? Let's go to the basic geology. In shale gas production, the idea is that the shale formation, which has a very large aerial extent, in some cases underlying major portions of whole states, like Pennsylvania, and there is gas virtually everywhere. It's not in large pockets as in a conventional gas well. It's not concentrated in a small area directly under a vertical well. It's distributed, non-uniformly, but distributed across a very, very large area. So think of that large area as your warehouse. You don't make money if you keep product in the warehouse. The product has to get out onto the showroom floor. It has to be produced. It has to be put into a pipeline. So if you have a large area, statewide, countywide, where you have gas, and you want to produce it all, you have to have many wells. Roughly speaking, nowadays, in a modern shale gas well, you create a pad, an area on the surface where you're going to start drilling, and from that pad, you can drill 8, 10, 12, 16, 20 wells, half of them going in one direction, half of them going in the other direction, and each one of those wells is draining something on the order of 80 to 100 surface acres. So think of wells per square mile. So now you take a typical county with a couple hundred square miles, and pretty soon you got 1,000 wells. And each one of those pads, of course, as I just said, might have 8, 10, 12 wells on it. You go a mile in any direction, and you'll see another pad. What the people of Pennsylvania experienced yet, for example, in the Marcellus Formation, where everybody's been very concerned about 4 years, what they realize is their future. Only about 2,500 Marcellus wells have been fracked and have gone into production in Pennsylvania in the last 4 years. Being hit by the industry, 100,000. I'll let that sink in for a minute. Dramatic pause. With all the hoopla, with all the protests, with all the accidents, with all the fines, with all the violations, with all the new regulations, all the new legislative shenanigans in Harrisburg, they're only 2.5% into the play.
No, I did not know so, that. I appreciate you sharing that with us. The magnitude of the problem is ahead of us.
Yes, exactly.
Well, then let's add something on to that, and I appreciate that answer. Would you please address the recent studies in the United States and the United Kingdom that have drawn a correlation between excessive hydrofracking and the increasing earth activities such as earth tremors and quakes, such as the rise in quakes in Arkansas and Ohio and northeast Texas and in England, and what is the scientific basis for this relationship? They're saying none, and yet I saw a report that showed in one area there had been no earth tremors or quakes ever recorded, and now where they put these wells, and when they put the water into these wells after it's been used, that's where these quakes are coming. And in 1 month, they had over 12 of these in one town, and where they had never had any before in their history, and the quakes came exactly where the wells were driven into the ground. So could you share your thoughts on this?
Sure. And there are two things to keep in mind here. The cause of these tremors, these earthquakes, and the magnitude. Let's talk about cause first. Some confusion in the literature, in the mainstream literature and the mainstream media, where they say, for example, fracking causes quakes. Well, that's true, and it's not true. In some instances the actual fracking process, the shale gas well, has triggered measurable earthquake activity. So let me jump over to the magnitude here for a minute. By measurable, people are commonly remember the Richter scale, you know, magnitude 3, magnitude 4. The earthquakes that have been shown to have been caused by the fracking process itself have been on the order of 2s. Those are not dangerous at the surface. They don't cause surface structure danger. They don't imperil humans or structures on the surface. However, it is possible that they could cause damage to the wells in particular, going back to my comments previously about having to gasket the wells with cement to seal them. Any kind of underground movements always imperils that seal. So my main concern right now with fracking earthquakes is not that there's potential damage at the surface, but that there's potential damage under the surface to the well structures. The larger earthquakes, the magnitude 4s and 5s that have been measured in Arkansas, Ohio, those are significant. Those can cause some amount of damage at the surface to structures. So there is an expense involved in them. These have been caused not by the fracking process itself, but by the injection of waste product from fracturing into what's called a Class 2 injection well. These are wells that regulated by or delegated for states, and they're supposed to be waste injection wells. Take that frack job someplace, you truck it to an injection well, you pump it down the injection well at a controlled rate, and you have engineered that well so that it doesn't frack, and supposedly it safely stores that for thousands of years. The problem is producing so much waste from jobs in various states, we're overloading those waste injection wells. We're pumping too much fluid too fast at too high a pressure, and we're getting waste injection wells in regions where they had not mapped previously existing faults. New pressure can cause those faults to slip, either by reducing the friction on them or by changing the pressure on them. And that's what causes earthquakes, slippage on faults. So what we're going to see as time goes on, if we're going to see another 100,000 wells in Pennsylvania and 50,000 more wells in Ohio, 20,000 more wells in West Virginia, and hundreds of thousands of wells across the country, is that product from the fracking, the volume of that waste product goes up. We have to put it someplace. If we keep pushing more of it down waste injection wells, we're going to be seeing more and more of these earthquakes. And no one at this point can guarantee that we're going to trigger something more significant than we've seen.
Just two more questions for you. Another promise Washington, the gas industry, has given us is that rural areas where fracking takes place would experience economic revitalization and increase in jobs. Is there any evidence that these promises have come true?
Well, again, Gary, that's in an area that's not my expertise.
Okay, then let me shift.
Perhaps I think Dominic might be the
right
first to address that question.
Then I will go to my last question for you. What is your estimate of the single greatest danger of hydrofracking that should give us the greatest pause to reconsider the consequences of increasing natural gas extraction?
That's a very simple one. It's the single largest threat to human health that humans could possibly bring about on themselves, climate change. By drastically increasing the production of methane through fracking of shale formations worldwide, we will be substantially increasing the load of not only carbon dioxide, but methane being emitted into the atmosphere at a time in the life of our planet, in the life of our species, when we can least afford it. We do not have 100 years to solve the climate change problem. We have less than half, perhaps half, of a human generation, 20 to 25 years, to make substantial reductions in total emissions of all greenhouse gases. And as I mentioned before, methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas over a short time frame, 20 years, than is carbon dioxide. So I hope I've answered that last question. I'll emphasize it again, climate change, climate change, climate change.
I appreciate you taking the time to have appeared with us today on the Progressive Commentary Hour. You've given us some very important insights that we're not getting from the rest of the media, not even the alternative media, and much appreciate your taking your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you for the opportunity.
Professor Ingraffia, Ingraffia, is the Dwight Baum Professor of Engineering at Cornell University, where he's taught structural and fractional mechanics for 35 years. And his website is psehealthyenergy.org. I'm Gary Nall. That was 40-minute interview. We're coming back. We do not limit ourselves in the time with this program. And we're going to go to our second and third guests, Jennifer Krell and Dominic Frangillo, in a moment. Please stay with us.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way.
I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. In the next two or three weeks, we're doing an in-depth analysis on the actual science behind chemtrails. You won't want to miss that one. Let us now say hello to Jennifer Crowell. I gave you her background early in the program. Nice to have you with us today, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
Before we look at the free pass our government legislators have given the natural gas industry, I'd like to first have you give us a general overview of the short and long-term adverse health effects we are witnessing in communities around the country where hydrofracking is most aggressive, and what are some of the more common illnesses we find clustered around hydrofracking regions.
We have found through our work at Earthworks, working in communities where people are directly impacted by oil and gas drilling and hydraulic fracturing, we have found that people suffer from a variety of health complaints. Rashes, shortness of breath, nosebleeds, ranging up to much more aggressive and harmful illnesses. We also find that livestock and pets often suffer from very devastating conditions. And part of the reason for that is that people may stop drinking the water themselves from their taps if they're concerned about its safety. But it's a lot harder to go out and buy bottled water for livestock or and sometimes for pets. And so the health impacts can be quite devastating. And we found that this comes from both water consumption itself as well as from the air emissions. So not only is methane, as Dr. Ingrafia pointed out earlier in this program, methane is a significant problem. Methane also carries with it volatile organic compounds that can themselves make people sick.
All right. Follow-up question then. We are being told that many of the ingredients in fracking fluid are proprietary chemicals and therefore cannot be made public. Do we know anything more about these secret ingredients and what their toxicity and health threats are?
We certainly don't know enough. There is some information available. The industry has created a website called Frack Focus, which a number of companies voluntarily disclose the ingredients in their fracking chemicals. The website isn't easy to search, and it doesn't aggregate the total amount of chemicals, but you can find some information on Frack Focus, and that includes a lot of information about some of the most toxic chemicals that we're concerned about. Not all companies disclose on Frack Focus. A few companies, particularly Halliburton, often claims trade secrets exemptions for the chemicals that they use in fracking, and when the companies claim that the chemicals are a trade secret, then the public doesn't get to find out what those chemicals are at all. Some states and some companies don't disclose the chemicals at all either.
Okay. I know from my decades opposing nuclear powered energy that the boom in nuclear power reactor construction before the mid-1970s was for the most part due to the numerous perks and subsidies the federal government provided and to free the industry from accountability in the event of a catastrophic accident. Natural gas fracking likewise mushroomed almost overnight, and also because the government made it feasible for gas companies to do as they wish. A lot of this has to do with the environmental exemptions and rollbacks the industry was granted. Would you please, Jennifer, share with us the major exemptions granted to the gas drillers with respect to the items we wouldn't know about, like the Safe Drinking Water Act or the Clean Water Act or any of the other acts, how they don't have to play by the same rules of accountability if they pollute these natural resources as anyone else?
Well, that's exactly right, Gary. We are looking at a dramatically uneven playing field when it comes to federal regulation of the oil and gas industry. We have an industry that enjoys exemptions from a number of our bedrock environmental laws. In 2005, the Energy Policy Act was passed under the Bush administration, and the Energy Policy Act exempted hydraulic fracturing from the Safe Drinking Water Act. This is around the time that we saw the shale gas boom take off in a number of areas, and we think that there's no big secret here that if you're exempt from the Safe Drinking Water Act, you can't be held accountable, you can't be held liable for polluting drinking water like other industries would be. And so the oil and gas industry can get away with harming water that is designated or may be potentially designated for drinking water from either above ground or underground sources. The industry also enjoys an exemption from the Clean Air Act, because each one of those individual wellheads, and right now we have 830,000 producing oil and gas wells across the United States, each one of those is a single source, and therefore the total aggregation of emissions isn't counted under the Clean Air Act. So other forms of other industries, places that are concentrated in one place, have to monitor and track emissions, and the oil and gas industry does not because of this Clean Air Act exemption for oil and gas wells. The exemption from the Clean Water Act has to do with stormwater runoff. Oil and gas is not responsible for managing its stormwater runoff the way that other industries are. This is an exemption that was also granted under that 2005 Bush-Cheney Energy Policy Act. The oil and gas industry is exempt from the law that governs how hazardous waste is managed in the United States, a law known as the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. Oil field wastes, incredibly to me, oil field wastes are not considered solid hazardous waste. They're not considered waste that needs to be managed under our own hazardous waste law. The industry is exempt from the Superfund law because many of the hazardous substances are exempted from the liability requirements of Superfund if they're found in crude oil or petroleum. The industry is exempt from the toxic release inventory. So this is a law that requires most industries to report significant toxic substance release, and oil and gas facilities are not required to make this report. So as you can see from this long, long list of exemptions, the oil and gas industry operates in a field of its own where it's not subject to the same environmental laws that you and I as citizens are required to follow, or that other companies and other industries are required to follow.
There's also the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act. There is also the Comprehensive Environmental Response and Liability Act. They're getting a free pass on all that. I have to believe that ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has been involved behind the scenes where it coaches state legislators on how to write bills that benefit its members, and I could not imagine that it wasn't involved. Do you have any knowledge of Alex getting these laws passed or these exemptions in place?
We don't know of Alex's involvement with the federal exemptions. Many of them are much older than what we've been tracking with Alex more recently. The Energy Policy Act of 2005, that is the loophole that exempted fracking from the Safe Drinking Water Act, is commonly known as the Halliburton loophole. And so we know that the industry has been involved in lobbying for these exemptions for a very, very long time. Where we have been noting where we're beginning to research Alex's involvement is in some of the states where new rules and regulations governing oil and gas drilling and hydraulic fracturing are being used. And that's information, honestly, Gary, that we're just beginning to grapple with. What is Alex's real involvement in these states? We're working to answer that question now.
I appreciate that. Although we associate the natural gas boom with President Bush, President Obama seems to have ignored it for the most part and let hydrofracking proceed through his term. Would you highlight for us what you're aware of concerning President Obama's current position on hydrofracking?
Well, President Obama has made it very clear that if oil and gas drilling and fracking are to occur, they need to be done safely. And that is it's an easily defensible position, because of course we don't want it done either if it isn't done safely. But it comes down to a question of can it be done safely? As Dr. Ingrafia pointed out, with the rate of well failure, with the fact that as wells age, the rate of failure increases, knowing that we have this massive impact on our landscape with 830,000 wells for drilling oil and gas, what defines safe? How much pollution is safe? How many air emissions are safe? And with these environmental exemptions, these are congressional exemptions. So there's also a limit to what the Obama administration can legally do unless we close these federal loopholes. The Obama administration can't fix the air pollution in the field where oil and gas drilling occurs on its own until this congressional exemption, this exemption to the Clean Air Act, is closed at the congressional level.
I would agree, but I also feel that it's rather disingenuous of the president to say we want it to be made safe. Of course he's going to say that. He does that with everything. We want safe nuclear power. We want, what's he going to say? No, we want irresponsible and dangerous. That, to me, he is completely pro-hydrofracking, as he's pro clean coal. That's an oxymoron. My last question is this. What are some of the bills and the works that we may use to rein in the gas industry, such as the Chemical Disclosure and the Breath Act and new regulatory conditions on hydrofracking by the EPA?
Well, there's a bill that has been introduced by Representative Diana DeGette from Colorado called the FRAC Act, that would force that would remove the exemption from the Safe Drinking Water Act. And that would go a long way towards correcting that one problem with the oil and gas industry. And we have been working to line up supporters and sponsors for that. There's also the BREATHE Act that would reduce the emissions from the oil and gas industry. And we are looking for sponsors to help correct some of the other loopholes that the oil and gas industry enjoys.
Good. You're doing great work over there with earthworksaction.org, and we hope you let us come in and help you, all of our listeners. The website is earthworksaction.org. Jennifer Kreil, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate your input.
Thanks so much, Gary.
And she is the new executive director for Earthworks. Our final panelist is Dominic Frangillo, and that's Frangillo, and his website is DominicFrangillo.com. Nice to have you with us today, Dominic.
Gary, thank you for having me.
All right. You live at the grassroots level, so my question is going to have you give us a little better understanding of what it is to be at that level. And the opening up the Marcellus shale bed in New York remains on the table, and there continues to be considerable concern that Governor Cuomo may give the green light to begin drilling. There was a New York Times piece in June that Cuomo plans to begin drilling in a limited manner in the deepest areas of the Marcellus shale rock formation for several years. This would occur in that portion of New York along the Pennsylvania border I mentioned earlier, south of where you are in Caroline. One concern I have is that this is a region steeped in rural poverty with no growing economy. So I'd first like you to give us your comments about Cuomo's plan and why you believe, if you do, that he is pushing forward with it against the wishes of New York residents.
Thank you, Gary. I think what people often have a misconception about what the southern tier and upstate New York is like, we actually have quite a thriving economy already. We have billions of dollars worth of income coming in with our wine industry, our agriculture industry, with tourism. We have clean water, which and a healthy environment, which in small businesses, which depend on that. And so what we're actually seeing is a threat to our rural economy. Many wineries, dozens of wineries, have signed on a letter to Governor Cuomo saying, if this comes in New York, it will jeopardize our entire industry. Well, no longer will we be known as the burgeoning wine region that we are. Same thing with tourism, same thing with the organic agriculture industry, which sells down to New York City. Many restaurants in Manhattan and the rest of New York City source their choices of goods from upstate New York. What will it be to our mean for our rural economy to have this move forward? I also think it's a political ploy by the governor to float these five counties. I don't think it has anything to do with the geology. It has to do with the political reality, which is that the state senator that represents the majority of the area in those five counties is Senator Libous, who has been a vocal fracking opponent. So this is really a political decision. And we've also seen that the New York City watershed has been exempt from gas drilling under the draft plans. The same thing with the Syracuse watershed. Well, if it's not safe for one city's watershed, then it's not safe for anyone. We're one state. We're all one New York. And if it's not safe anywhere in the state, then it's not safe for the whole state. So that's really our message. I've been working and founded, actually, Elected Officials to Protect New York, which is a group of now over 337 local elected officials from two-thirds of the counties in New York State. Bipartisan initiative all the way from Buffalo to Long Island, North Country down in Binghamton, signing on a letter to Governor Cuomo saying, hey, look, we represent the people. We're the front lines of this issue as local elected officials. We are concerned about the impacts on our water, on our tourism, on our economy, on our roads, on our tax bases, on our home mortgage values, on our first responders. We need much more study to be done and for fracking to be proven safe before it's ever allowed anywhere in New York State.
Good. What disturbs me, Dominic, is Governor Cuomo's plan that some person, such as Steve Horn of DeSmog Blog, claims it was hatched by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Can you speak on supposedly environmentally friendly green organizations that act as shills for corporations and their own interests?
Well, I know that there, and Dr. Ingrafia talked about this earlier, natural gas was seen as a clean transition fuel. More so than coal or oil. Even the term natural gas, though, is a marketing term for the industry. We don't call it natural coal or natural oil, but we call it natural gas. So it's the same thing. We're drilling for fossil methane gas underneath hundreds and hundreds of meters of rock. So let's call it what it is. It's methane gas. It's radioactive. The Marcellus Shale is the most radioactive shale gas that there is, radon, which is could cause hundreds of thousands and thousands of deaths from lung cancer, will be coming out of this gas. Well, a lot of the large environmental organizations actually saw this as a potential benefit because it was 60% cleaner burning than coal. That was before just a year ago we got the first peer-reviewed study that was co-authored by Grafia and Bob Howarth that found that that actually that's not the case, that it appears that gas is even greater than the emissions from coal. And so we're really seeing, I think, the large environmental groups across the country taking a second look at this and being like, well, we're learning a lot more about the impacts for people, that the health consequences, the consequences to our local economies. Maybe this is not as a good thing as we found. In fact, as Dr. Ingrafia said, that this is actually the single biggest thing we could do to aggravate and to grow our greenhouse gas emissions. This is a disaster for a climate. It's not a climate helper. It's a climate killer. And so we're seeing a turnaround on that as well.
How would the start of fracking in the Marcellus Shale affect the water of the Hudson watershed where residents in the greater New York metropolitan area rely upon water resources?
Sure, and that's a great question, and this is one example how we are one state, even though the draft plan currently has New York City exempted. Really, New York City residents stand to be concerned. So radon is an example. It's occurring in natural and the gas, but if it's piped to New York City, it's going to end up in the kitchens of our residents in New York City because it doesn't break down. So people should start checking their apartments right now to measure the radon content, because if the gas from the Marcellus comes in, we may see thousands of more deaths from lung cancer. That's just one example. Another example is the wastewater that will be coming through from upstate New York to Long Island, wastewater plants, trucking it through the New York City watershed. We know there's documented cases down in Pennsylvania and other states of these many hundreds and thousands of truck trips needed to carry this water and chemical-laden water, and those trucks having accidents and overturning. And if that happens anywhere in the New York City watershed, those spills will run downhill and affect the water supply. Also, again, climate change. It's worse for climate change. Manhattan, I was just in Manhattan yesterday, and the World Trade Center site is in a low-lying area. This hydraulic fracturing is going to sink large numbers of the areas of New York City because it's contributing to climate change. And another is, I was actually just walking on the High Line Park yesterday, and they're talking, Spectre Energy is talking about building plans for a high-pressure natural gas pipeline in this tri-state area, including a massive storage tank right next to the High Line Park. So then you have risks for leaks and explosions. This is not the kind of thing that is compatible with the New York State as we know it. This is not the kind of future that we were envisioning for ourselves. So it's time for us to stand up and to protect our state.
Okay, my final question is, would you educate our listeners about the major pro-fracking organizations that are trying to persuade New York residents about the pros and cons of fracking, always on the pro on their side? And what are some of the New York news outlets and sources that you've tried to give them information about what's wrong with gas hydrofracking, and they have ignored you?
So I'll answer that question by saying, as you talked about earlier, Gary, a lot of this is really being done at the grassroots level. So the first time that our people in our community started hearing about gas is when the lands people came, and they started knocking on doors, signing people up for leases in my town. Pretty soon we found that 55% of the land area in the town of Caroline, which borders Tioga County, was leased, 55%. And then people started hearing about on blogs and in some of the newspapers about this strange new term called fracking, and where you could light your water on fire and kids getting sick and cows dying in other states. And the more that people started hearing about it, the more people were very concerned. We were told there's nothing that we could do. I'm sorry, it's going to happen anyway in New York State. It's up to the state. Well, I'll share that what's happening in our town is remarkable. And a group of citizens, seven people, stood up and said, you know what, this is not going to happen. They started going door to door, and they educated residents, one-on-one conversations, sharing the information, sharing the websites that they got information from, bringing farmers from Pennsylvania up. And pretty soon, 40 people started going door to door with them, trying to get as many petition signatures as possible to come to our town board, our town council, to say, you know what, we don't want this in our town. And that petition was delivered in September of last year, with half of all registered voters in our town of Caroline signed on. It was by far the largest petition in our town's history. And then 2 months later, they voted 2-1 to remove two people from the town council who didn't want to take action and replace them with pro-ban people, people that wanted to protect our town. So this is a politically winning issue in our town, and now literally this Thursday we're going to have our public hearing on our draft plan, on our ban. This is playing out in town after town after town throughout New York State. Over 130 municipalities have passed bans or moratorium on hydraulic fracturing, and many, many more have citizens' movements uprising. This, the movement against natural gas and protecting our state of New York, is the largest grassroots movement in a generation or more in our state. And Governor Cuomo, I think, does not know what's coming. There's a huge action coming up on the 25th through 27th of this month in Albany, and I encourage everyone from New York City to come on up, because we are one state. This is going to affect everybody in New York City and everyone throughout all of New York State. If there is even just one spill, even just one, that's going to be a Superfund site that we all pay for. And that was a quote from a Republican council member in the city of Beacon in Dutchess County. You know, this is a bipartisan issue that we can all get around, that we really want a state that is protected for all New Yorkers. So I encourage everyone to go to nyagainstfracking.org. That's nyagainstfracking.org, and sign up for this event on the 25th to 27th of Albany. Take a bus from New York City up to Albany, take a train. We really need people to call the governor's office as well and say that we want the governor to protect our state.
We'll make this a primary call to action on my program and on our Progressive Radio Network website. Dominic, thank you very much for being out there and sharing your concerns and helping us show what is possible at the grassroots level. All the best to your efforts.
Thank you, Gary.
That is Dominic Frongillo, F-R-O-N-G-I-L-L-O, and that's his website. And we look forward to helping him in the cause and being up there to support that protest. I'm Gary Knoll. This brings us to the end of another Progressive Commentary Hour on gas hydrofracking. Hopefully, even with all the technical insights and the science that was discussed in depth, it's necessary to understand this at this level, because it's very easy to get people on the air who are pro-fracking and who do not share the proper context of an argument. And you don't have a rebuttal side, in which case then it becomes conditioned in someone's mind. I guess it's okay, hydrofracking. It isn't. Nor is nuclear. Nor is genetic engineered. Nor are many other things. And that's why we're here, to hold these forums. Have a nice day, everyone.